Chapter 10. Revolutionary Pamphlets. Pamphlets, those leaves of the hour and volumes of a season and even of a week, slight and evanescent things as they appear and scorned at by opposite parties while each cherishes their own, are in truth the records of the public mind, the secret history of a people. Isaac Disraeli, Amenities of Literature. In George Washington's cash accounts, the entry for August 6, 1774, contains the following item. Mr. Jefferson's Bill of Rights, 3-9. The entry may seem cryptic, but it really isn't. To be precise, Washington spent 3 shillings 9 pence to subscribe to a fund that would finance the publication of Thomas Jefferson's Summary View of the Rights of British America, a pamphlet the Williamsburg printer Clementina Rind would issue in a matter of days. Washington was one of several Virginia patriots who subscribed to the fund to publish the work. From the summer of 1774 through the following winter, he added numerous other pamphlets to his library that tracked the revolutionary fervor as war between America and Great Britain loomed. Thomas Jefferson had not composed his work for publication. Neither had he provided its title, A Summary View of the Rights of British North America. He wrote it as a resolution to present before the Virginia Convention, the extra-legal gathering in Williamsburg designed to debate what should be done regarding the Crown's increasingly callous and belligerent attitude toward the American colonies. After leaving Monticello for Williamsburg, Jefferson was struck down with a case of dysentery. He returned home but sent copies of his manuscript to Williamsburg, where it caused a considerable stir. Peyton Randolph, who would be elected chair of the Virginia Convention, received one of the 2 manuscript copies Jefferson had prepared. It was read aloud one evening at Randolph's Williamsburg home to a large group of people. Edmund Randolph, Peyton's nephew, recalled the applause the work elicited that evening. Peyton Randolph's guests recognized that Jefferson had gone much further than anyone before him had dared. "The young ascended with Mr. Jefferson to the source of those rights," Edmund Randolph recalled, "but the old required time for consideration before they could tread this lofty ground, which, if it had not been abandoned, it at least had not been fully occupied throughout America." Despite the work's enthusiastic reception among the revolutionaries, the Virginia Convention found Jefferson's ideas much too radical to sanction officially. Though the Virginia Convention failed to approve Jefferson's resolution, his supporters saw they could outmaneuver the convention by putting his words in print and thus giving them a wider currency. George Washington's role in the publication of Jefferson's pamphlet has so far gone unnoticed, but the entry in his cash accounts, brief as it is, reveals his active participation in bringing the pamphlet to print. Dated August 6th, the last day of the Virginia Convention, and at least 2 days before Summary View was published, the entry reveals that Washington was not merely buying a copy of the pamphlet, he was contributing to the cost of publishing it. Washington's description of the work, Mr. Jefferson's Bill of Rights, suggests that, as of August 6, 1774, the forthcoming pamphlet had yet to gain its final title. The title Washington temporarily gave it not only captures the work's essence, it also reveals his view of the significance of Jefferson's pamphlet to political history. In modern American culture, the phrase Bill of Rights, of course, refers to the list of rights that form the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Before the American Bill of Rights, the phrase generally referred to the English Bill of Rights, which Parliament had presented to William and Mary, then the Prince and Princess of Orange, in the late 17th century, basing their accession to the English throne on their acknowledgement of these rights. Washington was familiar with the text of the English Bill of Rights. Tobias Smollett had reprinted it in his Complete History of England. equating Jefferson's work with the English Bill of Rights, Washington revealed how he understood the task the American colonists faced. Essentially, they had to repeat what the English citizenry had done the previous century, that is, assert their fundamental rights as British subjects. Invoking the English Bill of Rights to describe Jefferson's bold statement of the rights of colonial British subjects in North America, Washington also revealed his cyclical view of history. Whenever a sovereign power infringes upon the rights of its citizenry, the people must rise to reassert their rights. The active role Washington played in the publication of Jefferson's summary view in August 1774 is consistent with his behavior during earlier times of political conflict. With each controversy of the past, Washington had obtained the most pertinent pamphlets available. During the so-called Parson's Cause, he acquired pamphlets on both sides of the controversy over the Two Penny Act, which sought to curb the salaries of Virginia clergymen during an economic downturn. After the Stamp Act's repeal, Washington obtained a copy of The Examination of Dr. Benjamin Franklin, a transcript of Franklin's testimony before the House of Commons regarding the Stamp Act, which was crucial in securing its repeal. With further British incursions on colonial American rights in the late 1760s, Washington obtained John Dickinson's Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. On both constitutional and theoretical grounds, Dickinson made a strong case for opposing the measures the British imposed on the American colonies. Jefferson's summary view caps a flurry of revolutionary activity that had taken place since the Boston Tea Party, which had occurred in December 1773. Attending the House of Burgesses in May 1774, the Virginians had learned about the Boston Port Bill and the other intolerable acts, the punitive measures passed by Parliament in the wake of the Tea Party. Washington had voted for a resolution calling for a day of prayer and fasting to protest the intolerable acts and to show Virginia's solidarity with Massachusetts. Learning about the resolution, Governor Dunmore dissolved the House of Burgesses. "This dissolution," Washington informed a correspondent, "was as sudden as unexpected, for there were other resolves of a much more spirited nature ready to be offered to the House, which would have been adopted respecting the Boston Port Bill, but were withheld till the important business of the country could be gone through." After the governor dissolved the House, Washington went to the Raleigh Tavern with the other burgesses, where they could debate what to do. They agreed to a general congress of representatives from throughout colonial America and arranged the Virginia Convention for August, when they hoped that some vigorous measures will be effectually adopted to obtain that justice which is denied to our petitions and remonstrances. Besides providing a forum for articulating their grievances, the Virginia Convention would also elect delegates to the First Continental Congress. So far, Washington's revolutionary activities had not precluded his intellectual pursuits. On Wednesday, June 15th, he went to the Capitol in Williamsburg to attend a meeting of the Virginia Society for the Advancement of Useful Knowledge. Modeled on both the Royal Society of London and the American Philosophical Society, this scientific organization had been established the previous year and had met sporadically since then. Washington had joined in November 1773. He renewed his membership at the June meeting, as did others, including Jefferson. The meeting was well attended, and those members present elected a new slate of officers. John Page of Rosewell was elected president and George Wythe vice president. Jefferson called the organization the Society of Arts, a shorthand name emphasizing its role in the development of new technology that could be put to practical use. At the June meeting, members voted to grant John Hobday a medal and a monetary award for the model of his newly invented wheat threshing machine, which the Society found ingenious. Also at this meeting, they elected several corresponding members of the Society, including Benjamin Franklin, John Coakley Lettsam, David Rittenhouse, Benjamin Rush, and John Smibert. Electing corresponding members from Philadelphia to Boston, the Virginians demonstrated a sense of intercolonial cooperation. Their scientific correspondence thus parallels the current work of revolutionary committees of correspondence throughout the American colonies. Electing Lettsam, a British physician, as well as other British scientists, the Virginians demonstrated that intellectual and scientific pursuits transcended political divisions. Political conflict need not stand in the way of scientific progress. The same day he attended the meeting of the Society for the Advancement of Useful Knowledge, Washington purchased a pamphlet by Samuel Henley, A Candid Refutation of the Heresy Imputed by Robert C. Nicholas, Esquire to the Reverend S. Henley. Professor Henley had been one of the founding members of the Society and had served as its first secretary. After coming to Virginia, he involved himself in much religious and political controversy. A savage polemicist who pushed against the bounds of propriety, Henley had engaged in a heated newspaper correspondence with Robert Carter Nicholas over the previous year. This pamphlet sought to refute Nicholas's latest charge, that Henley was a heretic. A Candid Refutation is an odd mix of erudition and idiosyncrasy. Nicholas had used much hearsay to demonstrate Henley's alleged heresy. He had quoted words that his wife and others, Mary Carey Ambler, Richard Bland, John Page, had supposedly heard Henley say. Some of these statements were taken out of context. Henley was a wag and an instigator. He often tossed off challenging ideas in conversation as a way to shock and provoke others, to get them thinking more deeply. He did not necessarily intend such bold remarks to be taken seriously or to be used against him. A Candid Refutation also reflects Henley's scholarly bent. His footnotes are filled with erudite references and quotations, a few in Latin or French. Some footnotes have footnotes of their own. Still, they are not without a sense of fun. Arguing that descriptions of devilish possession should not be taken literally, Henley supplied a footnote recounting Bishop Smallbroke's discussion of devils that enter a herd of swine, Mark chapter 5, verses 12 and 13. The bishop allotted 3 and a fraction to each animal in the herd. Smallbroke's division earned him the nickname Bishop Split Devil. Washington's surviving copy of Henley's Candid Refutation shows that he read the work carefully. After the preface, a list of errata appears under the heading Errors Which the Reader is Requested to Correct. Washington followed this instruction, making numerous manuscript corrections to the text throughout his copy of Henley's pamphlet. A Candid Refutation can be read as both an erudite religious treatise and a contribution to local gossip. The Virginians mentioned in the text were Washington's friends, so he was naturally curious about what Henley had to say about them. Sometimes the erudition was beyond him, but Washington knew several of the books Henley referenced: Addison's Cato, Milton's Paradise Lost, The Spectator, and others. Besides his eloquent defense against Nicholas's slander, what shows most clearly in A Candid Refutation is Henley's understanding of the relationship between reason and faith. Henley calls himself a rational Christian and argues that Scripture can withstand scrutiny. Subjecting religion to reason, in Henley's view, could only strengthen belief. In July 1774, Washington had attended meetings in Alexandria, Virginia, with other interested citizens of Fairfax County to debate what should be done about British encroachments on American freedom. Together, he and George Mason co-authored the Fairfax County Resolves, which called for a boycott of British goods, expressed support for Boston, and agreed to the meeting of a Continental Congress. They presented the Fairfax County resolves to the public on Monday, July 18th, at the county courthouse in Alexandria. The citizens of Fairfax County adopted the resolves and named Washington the head of a committee to take charge of the county's interests. During the Virginia Convention, Washington was elected one of seven Virginia delegates to the First Continental Congress, scheduled to convene in Philadelphia the following month. In addition, the delegates passed an association, that is, a document setting forth their common purpose. Clementina Rind printed it as a half-sheet broadside under the title, An Association, signed by 89 members of the late House of Burgesses. Washington purchased several copies of this broadside, some to distribute to his neighbors in Fairfax County, others to take with him to Philadelphia. The Virginia Association would serve as a model for the association the First Continental Congress would pass. Patrick Henry and Edmund Pendleton, two other delegates to the Continental Congress, came to Mount Vernon on Tuesday, August 30th, so they could set out for Philadelphia together the next day. Washington had much farm business to take care of beforehand. Isaac Hobday, who was traveling through Virginia to encourage farmers to adopt his brother's wheat threshing machine, reached Mount Vernon this Tuesday. Having seen a working model at a meeting of the Society for the Advancement of Useful Knowledge, Washington was already convinced of its usefulness. He engaged Isaac Hobday's services to oversee the construction of a new wheat threshing machine at Mount Vernon. The last day of August proved to be exceedingly hot, as Washington recorded in his weather log, but Martha gave the trio a good send-off. Pendleton came away from Mount Vernon quite impressed with her. Afterward, he told a friend, "I was much pleased with Mrs. Washington and her spirit. She seemed ready to make any sacrifice and was very cheerful, though I know she felt very anxious. She talked like a Spartan mother to her son on going to battle. I hope you will all stand firm. I know George will," she said. "God be with you, gentlemen." Traveling by horseback, the three arrived in Philadelphia on Sunday, September 4th, and headed for the City Tavern, or as it was also known, the New Tavern. Located on 2nd Street, the City Tavern contained several large club rooms, which made it an ideal gathering place for delegates to the First Continental Congress. Along with the others, Washington returned here on Monday, when all their credentials were read. Together, they elected Peyton Randolph president and Charles Thompson secretary. In addition, they chose a place for the Continental Congress to meet. The Carpenters Guild of Philadelphia kindly offered Carpenters Hall, a handsome Georgian building on Chestnut Street, as a meeting place. The delegates accepted the offer. Unlike Patrick Henry, Washington was not a great public speaker, but he did articulate his thoughts in conversation with others. Silas Dean, a delegate from Connecticut, said that Washington speaks very modestly in a cool but determined style and accent. More of a listener than a speaker, he heard what others had to say and recognized what to do to get things done. As Patrick Henry said, "Colonel Washington, who has no pretensions to eloquence, is a man of more solid judgment and information than any man on the floor." By the time the First Continental Congress adjourned in late October, it had passed a series of resolutions, which were collected together as an association to which the delegates affixed their names. The association, etc., as it was simply titled, was printed in Philadelphia as both a pamphlet and a broadside, and reprinted in Boston as a broadside. The pamphlet was easier to tote around, but the broadside was ideal for posting as a public document for all to read. Upon reading The Association, etc., one loyalist poet found it ripe for parody. In revolutionary America, the versification was a form of political parody used by both patriots and loyalists. It basically involved taking a serious piece of prose and rendering it into satirical verse. Since the Stamp Act, numerous political speeches, proclamations, and other official documents had been parodied through versification. That The Association, etc., would share the same fate seems almost inevitable. Sure enough, it was soon versified and published. It appeared under the name Bob Jingle, the pseudonymous satirist who facetiously styled himself Poet Laureate to the Congress, but whose true identity remains unknown. Titled The Association, etc., of the Delegates of the Colonies at the Grand Congress held at Philadelphia September 1, 1774, versified and adapted to music, this versification consists of three parts: a ballad, a recitativo in heroic couplets, and a chorus in tetrameter couplets. At the end, the pamphlet reprints Continental Congress's Association, apparently to demonstrate the cleverness of the versification by letting interested readers compare Bob Jingle's verse compared to the original prose. Though written to spoof the Congressional Association, this pamphlet helped circulate it further. Pundits nowadays worry about the American people receiving political information from parodies of the news. As Bob Jingle's Association and the numerous other revolutionary versifications show, Americans have been receiving political news through parody since the nation began. The fact that George Washington had a copy of Bob Jingle's Association in his library indicates his attitude toward such parodies. Curious about the opposition to the Continental Congress, he eagerly read what others thought about its actions. His ownership of the work further reflects both open-mindedness and a sense of humor. Washington had enjoyed reading poetry since boyhood, and he was unafraid to hear what others thought about him and his role as a delegate to the Continental Congress. The Congressional Association amounted to an agreement among the American colonists not to import or consume materials from Great Britain, nor to export agricultural products to Great Britain. This non-importation, non-consumption, and non-exportation agreement, to use the language of the Association, provided a way to protest the actions of Parliament and redress the grievances of the American people. Transposing the language of the Continental Congress into ballad stanzas, Bob Jingle intones, "That these are mighty grievances must be by all consent, therefore we will exert our might to get them straight redressed. The method we have hit upon to bring this scheme to bear is import, export, consump, none, and this will do it, we swear." Bob Jingle uses many of the same words he found in The Association, etc., but the ones he adds change the tone considerably. Having Congress call the agreement a method we have hit upon, Bob Jingle detracts from the careful deliberations that occurred in Carpenter's Hall that September and October. He makes it seem as if the delegates had stumbled upon the idea for the agreement purely by chance. Having Congress say, "And this will do it, we swear," Bob Jingle portrays the delegates as immature and uncertain of themselves. Theirs are the words of a schoolboy trying to convince classmates about something he is unsure of himself. The middle part of Congress's text enumerates a series of measures the Americans would take to assure the success of the Association. Number 8, for example, encouraged economy, frugality, and industry, and promoted the development of American manufacturing. It discouraged such forms of extravagance and dissipation as cockfighting, gaming, and horse racing. Furthermore, it simplified mourning practices, freeing Americans from having to wear mourning dress and letting them express their sorrow simply. a black crepe armband for men and a black ribbon or necklace for women. Congress also discouraged the practice of giving gloves and scarves at funerals. Converting this eighth measure into heroic couplets, Bob Jingle presents the following verse paragraph. And eighthly, when we are quite rid of our trade and stripped of our money, mere shepherds are made. We'll see no horse racings, nor e'en a cockfight, our only diversions to eat, sleep, and shite. And when a son dies, we will take no more notice than as if one should say, I know nor care who 'tis. With a piece of black crepe, we will sit down content when all our old clothes are quite tattered and rent. The giving of gloves and of scarves will decry. When we've got none to give, faith, let who will die. Bob Jingle obviously wonders whether a ban on cockfighting and mourning dress will really help enforce the non-consumption agreement. By themselves, the individual components of the eighth measure may seem insignificant, but they show how delegates to the Continental Congress questioned all aspects of their lives and scrutinized long-standing social customs to probe their fundamental significance. When it came to the tradition of mourning dress, for example, they could see how unnecessary it was. Far from an expression of sorrow, it seemed like a tradition that contributed to British coffers. Mourning dress was expensive and had to be ordered from Britain. Americans did not have to wear British mourning dress to convey the loss they felt upon the death of a loved one. The tetrameter couplet, a vehicle for parody since Samuel Butler wrote Hudibras in the 17th century, was already a well-established form for humorous satirical verse among early American poets, structuring such masterworks as Ebenezer Cook's Sotweed Factor and Robert Bowling's Neanthe. Bob Jingle suggests that one particularly sly delegate to the Continental Congress, a crafty Reynard, forced the others to sign the association against both their will and their better judgment. Bob Jingle's versification may be the most entertaining pamphlet to critique the First Continental Congress, but numerous others appeared as well. Some pamphleteers used the sterner vehicle of prose to articulate their opposition. Free Thoughts on the Proceedings of the Continental Congress, to sample another work from Washington's library, appeared the month after Congress adjourned. The author published the work pseudonymously, identifying himself solely as a farmer on the title page. Colonial writers, including some who had little to do with farming, commonly used this pseudonym to appeal to their American readers. John Dickinson, a Philadelphia lawyer, assumed the persona of a Pennsylvania farmer to articulate his political views. The farmer pseudonym manifests another 18th-century American ideal, namely the ideal of classical agrarianism, which viewed rural life as a source of virtue, health, and happiness. At the end of Free Thoughts, the author provides an additional clue to his actual identity, signing himself A.W. Farmer. It did not take long for New York readers to recognize that the A was not an initial, but an indefinite article, and that W was short for Westchester. A.W. Farmer was none other than Reverend Samuel Seabury, rector of Westchester, New York. A contributor to the New York Journal described how contemporary readers reacted to Seabury's Free Thoughts. When the pamphlet was read aloud before a gathering of 20 or 30 people, they condemned it as one of the most treacherous, malicious, and wicked productions that has yet appeared from the implacable enemies of the British colonies and nation. This contributor exaggerates, but his words do reflect the animosity Seabury provoked. Free Thoughts appeared without a printer's or a publisher's name, but some of its opponents suspected that the Tory publisher James Rivington had printed the work, and they burned copies of Free Thoughts on his doorstep. Maintaining the farmer persona throughout the work, Seabury raised some valid points about the association's enforceability. Congress intended to appoint local enforcement committees to assure compliance with the non-consumption aspect of the agreement. Seabury felt the activities of the committee men would be an invasion of privacy. While his objections to the practicality of the association have some validity, he failed to understand the ideological and philosophical basis of Congress's grievances. Seabury ignored the basic idea of equality underlying the American cause. He observed, "If I must be enslaved, let it be by a king at least, and not by a parcel of upstart lawless committeemen. If I must be devoured, let me be devoured by the jaws of a lion, and not gnawed to death by rats and vermin." In other words, Seabury accepted the long-standing concept of the chain of being, the hierarchy that placed lion above rat, king above man. He refused to acknowledge the radical concept of the American revolutionaries, that king and committee man are both men, neither one fundamentally better or worse than the other. After each day in the Continental Congress, Washington maintained a busy social schedule, dining with other delegates as well as prominent Philadelphia merchants, magistrates, and intellectuals. In his diary, he recorded whom he dined with and where he went after dinner, but provided no additional details. Journals and reminiscences of others sometimes help paint a fuller picture. On Monday, October 17th, for example, Washington wrote that he spent the evening at the home of Thomas Mifflin, a Philadelphia merchant who represented Pennsylvania in the Continental Congress. Washington's diary contains no additional information about the evening, but Benjamin Rush described it in his autobiography, Travels Through Life. Still in his 20s, Rush had already established himself as one of Philadelphia's leading physicians. Besides being a man of science, he was also a fine writer who understood the value of recording anecdotes for posterity. This evening, Mifflin's company included John Adams, Samuel Adams, and Charles Lee, a British Army officer who had cast his lot with the American patriots. Impressed with Lee's extensive military experience, Washington was happy to have him on the American side, at least at first. Rush was initially quite impressed with Washington. After meeting him in 1775, he informed a correspondent, "He has so much martial dignity in his deportment that you would distinguish him to be a general and a soldier from among 10,000 people. There is not a king in Europe that would not look like a valet de chambre by his side." On this particular evening, those gathered at Mifflin's home considered the consequences of the actions taken by the First Continental Congress. As Rush recalled, John Adams said that he did not expect Great Britain to redress the colonial grievances, nor did he foresee the possibility of reconciliation. Rush recorded a toast John Adams uttered on the occasion. "Cash and gunpowder to the Yankees," Adams exclaimed as he lifted his glass. Though Congress continued to meet until October 26, 1774, some of the Virginia delegates left Philadelphia to reach Williamsburg in time to attend the House of Burgesses, which was scheduled to convene the first Thursday in November. Before they left, Richard Bland, Benjamin Harrison, and Peyton Randolph placed their trust in Washington and authorized him to vote for them. That Washington stayed until Congress adjourned indicates the diligence and seriousness with which he accepted his position as delegate. The evening Congress adjourned, Wednesday, October 26th, the delegates hosted a gathering at the New Tavern to honor those citizens of Philadelphia who had entertained them while Congress had been in session. Rush also recorded this event for posterity. He observed, "The company was large and the conversation animated by the most fervid patriotism." The evening was filled with enthusiastic toasts and playful banter. William Livingston of New Jersey, who had a great reputation as a wit, contributed very much to the pleasure of this evening by his facetious stories and conversation. Rush found most memorable Samuel Ward's prophetic words. A delegate from Rhode Island, Ward believed that not only would the American Revolution provide the basis for government in the New World, it would inspire other nations around the globe. May the fire which has been recently kindled upon the altar of liberty in America enlighten all the nations of the world into a knowledge of their rights, Ward toasted. When Washington left for Mount Vernon, he asked his friend William Milnor to send him additional political pamphlets as they appeared. Milnor complied, and in November sent an anonymous pamphlet titled A Friendly Address to All Reasonable Americans on the Subject of Our Political Confusions. With this vile pamphlet, as he called it, Milnor also sent a refutation. Strictures on a pamphlet entitled A Friendly Address to All Reasonable Americans on the Subject of Our Political Confusions. Anticipating how Washington would react, Milnor wrote, If you have patience to read the first, I think you will be diverted with the last. The first work, which came from the pen of the Reverend Dr. Thomas Bradbury Chandler, is not nearly as well written as Seabury's Free Thoughts, nor is its argument as cogent. Chandler preys upon his reader's fears, asserting the infallibility of Great Britain and assuming that any challenge to the mother country would be crushed. William Hooper, a North Carolina delegate, called this so-called friendly address a trifling performance and recognized its author's shameless fear-mongering. Hooper complained, "The author has wrote to the passions to inflame and mislead weak minds. He has conjured up the horrors of a civil war to affright the timid." Despite Hooper's dislike of A Friendly Address, he was upset by what happened to the pamphlet in Philadelphia, where patriots treated it the same way New York patriots had treated Seabury's Free Thoughts. Hooper informed a correspondent that through a mistaken zeal of the people, the friendly address had been prevented from being sold publicly in Philadelphia. He continued, "Strange infatuation that while we contend with enthusiastic ardor for the liberty of the press ourselves, that we should with such an intolerating spirit deny it to others. It is a strange freedom that is confined to one side of a question. Doctrines in politics that will not bear a freedom of discussion carry with them more than a suspicion of being erroneous, and I am confident that the world will not be so easily gulled in these as in the unquestionable mysteries of church faith. They will take the freedom to think for themselves and even to condemn what will not, upon a fair dispassionate inquiry, stand the test of solid reason and sound criticism." The best way to treat such a trifling work, Hooper believed, would simply be to ignore it. But it was not ignored. A lengthy rebuttal appeared in the New York Journal by an author who styled himself Americanus. The finest response came from Charles Lee, the author of Strictures on a Friendly Address, the other pamphlet Milnor sent Washington. Besides being an experienced soldier, Lee was also an accomplished scholar, and he applied both skills in his rebuttal to Chandler's friendly address. Lee brought many other aspects of his irascible personality to bear. His wit and his vanity, a gift for satire combined with flippancy, confidence in his own personal knowledge, and a deep animosity toward those in power. Contemptuous of both King and Parliament, which had ignored his military talents, Lee had come to America just 1 year earlier and quickly taken the side of the colonists against British tyranny. Chandler's friendly address provided an ideal platform for articulating his ideas. Milnor was right. strictures is great fun after the doom and gloom of A Friendly Address. Charles Lee may have met Washington 2 decades earlier when they served together under General Braddock during his disastrous expedition against Fort Duquesne, but they became good friends when Washington was in Philadelphia for the First Continental Congress. Washington invited Lee to visit Mount Vernon. Lee accepted the invitation, arriving on December 30th and staying until January 4th. His stay gave the two much time to talk, and Lee's stories of his military experiences greatly impressed Washington. Besides serving in the French and Indian War, Lee had served under General John Burgoyne in a British expedition to Spain, as aide-de-camp to King Stanislaus of Poland, and as a major general in the Polish army. In addition, he had joined the Russian army in Moldavia to fight against the invading Turks. Washington received a number of other pamphlets in the aftermath of the First Continental Congress, not all of which were political. Or perhaps they were. In times of conflict, everything becomes political, even farming. Take the case of An Essay on the Culture and Management of Hemp. Solely by its title, this 52-page pamphlet may seem like an agricultural treatise, but the circumstances of its publication closely resemble those of contemporary political pamphlets. Prior to its publication, An Essay on Hemp was read aloud to several members of the Annapolis Committee of Safety, who, as Charles Carroll of Carrollton informed Washington, were so impressed with the work that they recommended its publication. By the first week of March 1775, it was in press. Before printing was complete, Carroll wrote to Washington, suggesting that the pamphlet would be particularly useful to the American colonies during the present conflict. With his letter, Carroll included some sample pages from An Essay on Hemp. He hoped Washington would help distribute the work in Virginia. Aware that a second Virginia convention was fast approaching, Carroll thought it would provide an ideal opportunity to promote the pamphlet in Virginia. There is no evidence to indicate that Washington served as Virginia agent for this pamphlet, as Carroll hoped, but he did obtain a copy of the complete work, which he added to his agricultural library at Mount Vernon. In March 1775, delegates to the Virginia Convention from all parts of the colony headed to Richmond and assembled at St. John's Church. Richmond had been chosen over Williamsburg as the gathering place for the convention this year because the local citizens who stood up to the British administration were increasingly unwelcome in the colonial capital. This group of over 100 men included nearly all of Virginia's foremost leaders. The convention began on Monday, March 20th, when the delegates began discussing the dire situation the American colonists faced. By Thursday, the debate had reached a fever pitch. Many Virginians recognized the necessity of war, but some still needed convincing. Washington's friend Patrick Henry rose to the occasion, delivering the most memorable speech of the convention and of his life, the speech that ends with the exclamation, "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." As part of its proceedings, the Virginia Convention also elected delegates to the Second Continental Congress. Peyton Randolph received the largest number of votes, with Washington second and Henry third. Thomas Jefferson was elected first alternate, in case Peyton Randolph would be unable to fulfill his responsibilities as a delegate, which proved to be the case. Congress was scheduled to convene in May, but before it met, the Massachusetts militia and the British Army clashed at Lexington and Concord. The war had begun.